All right, again, the handout for tonight is going to say the flow of Exodus. And if you don't have a handout of the plagues, there should be one back there as well. But we passed those out a couple class periods ago. Basically looking at the first 12 chapters of Exodus tonight, which is going to incorporate, of course, the plagues and several other things. So we've got quite a bit to cover. Here. Just thinking here about the first couple of chapters right off the bat, we have, of course, between the end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus, we have some time that passes. It's hard to say exactly how much time, but enough time for, you know, a generation or two to pass so that a Pharaoh has come to power who doesn't know Joseph. And so he's looking over here, and the Egyptians do not like shepherds. We see that. And the Israelites are in Goshen, so they're kind of separated from the rest of Egypt. But what's the fear that this Pharaoh has? They're getting too big. They're growing too much. And so there's a fear that they might at some point rebel. And so what's his answer? He has two answers to this. The first one is to do what to them? Turn them into slaves. Okay, so now we can control them. So that's their first answer to it. What's the second answer? Kill the young boys, basically, as they're born. And why the boys? Why not... They're not worried about what the girls are going to do. Plus, you know, the boys would be the ones who would grow up to be the soldiers and, you know, the fighters and that kind of thing. So they have that fear, and so this is what Pharaoh enacts. Now, kind of an interesting story here in chapter 1, that as Pharaoh tells the midwives to kill the boys, what do the midwives do? They do not kill the boys. In fact, you know, it's an interesting story here. Verse 17 says, the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. Now, sometimes there's a question. I'm just going to throw this out for quick thinking here. Sometimes there's a question about the fact that when Pharaoh asks them why they did this, did they lie? Because they say the Hebrew women are not as Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them. And then verse 20 says, so God was good to the midwives. And sometimes people have assumed that they're lying about that. My question is, what would make us think they're lying? I don't think they are. In other words, if God is helping the situation, maybe what they describe is exactly what happens. And so it's already done. But they're not going to go back and you know, kill the babies or anything like that. But the point is, they feared God. They did what God wanted, and God was good to them. And it says, because they feared God, verse 21, he established households for them. And then Pharaoh commands everybody. He's not going to trust the midwives anymore, so he commands everybody, throw the babies into the Nile and keep the daughters alive. Now, just bear in mind that it's under these circumstances, of course, that Moses is going to be born. And so what that tells us is you're looking at a very difficult time. The Jews have already become slaves. Pharaoh's trying to kill all the young boys somehow. And, you know, now Moses is born. And what does Moses' mother decide to do? You know the story. Put him in a little ark. Yeah, by the way, it's the same word for ark, you know. Put him in a little ark. Put him in a little basket. Put him on the Nile. So, yeah, she puts him in the Nile, but just so he's floating. And, of course, as it turns out, who finds her? Who finds him? Pharaoh's daughter. She's the one that names him Moses. She drew him out of the Nile, drawn out. That's the idea. And, of course, then the other issue here is, who is it that's kind of looking on when Pharaoh's daughter does all this? His sister is there. And she says, hey, Why don't we go get a nurse? And she's able to get Moses' own mother. And so, as it turns out, Moses' mother is able to nurse him, take care of him for the first little while. And who knows what all she was able to teach him. But the point is that she had access to him along with Pharaoh's daughter. So that's the situation. And it's fitting because Moses is going to grow up as the son of Pharaoh's daughter while at the same time becoming aware that he's also a Hebrew. And of course, that's going to create some of the tension that occurs in the next few chapters as a result of this. Well, again, the story moves very quickly. Moses grows up. We don't know much about his childhood. He grows up and comes across an Egyptian beating on a Hebrew one day. And what does he do? Kills the Egyptian. And here's some of the, part of the thing to kind of bear in mind here is that apparently Moses is kind of thinking of himself as somewhat of a deliverer. Because the next day he sees two Hebrews fighting, and what does he do? Hey, we're brothers. Let's get along, right? Oh, we heard about you killing the Egyptian. Well, now Moses finds out that, you know, this is a known thing. He thought it was a secret and finds out about this. And so, you know, and I think what's interesting about the overall story of Moses here is that when he thinks he's ready to do this, he's not. It's when he doesn't think he's ready to do this that he is. Isn't that interesting? Sometimes the best qualified people are the ones who really are humble enough to think maybe they're not the ones for the job, but they are. But anyway, Moses, of course, now afraid that Pharaoh's going to find him and kill him, takes off. And where does he go? He flees to Midian. Now, Midian is on the other side of the rabbit ears of the Dead Sea, or the, not the Dead Sea, the Red Sea, the Gulf of Suez, and all that. So there's the Sinai Peninsula is right there, and I did not have my thing with me tonight to plug in, so I don't get that up there. But if you're looking at any maps of being in the back of your Bibles and so forth, Midian's on the other side of the Sinai Peninsula. You got the rabbit ears that come up, the peninsula that comes down in there, and then the other side of that. So Midian is where he goes, and what's he going to do there for the next 40 years? And he's 40. So you've got the first 40 years, he's in Egypt. Second 40 years, he's in Midian. Third 40 years, what's he doing? He's leading the people through the wilderness. Okay? All right, so he becomes a shepherd. Again, the very thing that the Egyptians hate. He becomes a shepherd. And how does he find his wife? All right, what happened? Some guys were picking on her, and Moses, of course, defends her, comes to her aid, and she falls in love with him. The rest is history, right? All right, so, yeah, he finds his wife this way, and what's her name? Zipporah. And so he marries her, and who is the father-in-law? What's his name? He has two names. Reuel and Jethro. Jethro is a good old country boy name, so we'll go with it. As it turns out, of course, Jethro is going to play a pretty significant role in Moses' life, giving counsel and so forth. So we'll see some of that a little bit later. Jethro. All right, one thing, and I've had this question probably at least three times this week, has to do with when Gershom is born, and then Zipporah gets mad at him and circumcises him, and all. What's going on there? I mean, this seems to come out of nowhere that God gets angry with Moses and essentially says, "I'm going to kill him." So what's happening here? Well, this is one of those occasions where there's not a lot of detail given to us. We don't have the full story, okay? What I would simply suggest is something like along these lines. The boy is born. Moses, as an heir of the family of Abraham, what's he supposed to do? He's supposed to circumcise his son. I'm assuming he knows enough to do that. You know, he knows enough about being a Hebrew that he would know to do this. He doesn't do it. Maybe because Zipporah doesn't want him to. I don't know. Maybe she's the one who doesn't, and he goes along with it. God gets angry enough, lets that be known, and so Zipporah finally herself circumcises them, basically, you know, goes back to Moses, and she's mad at him, you know, and makes her accusation. But it alleviates the whole circumstance there. But if nothing else, that tells you that the circumcision covenant was certainly very important to God and wasn't just going to let that go. Okay? All right. So that takes us into then the situation of the first couple of chapters. God now, of course, is going to appear to Moses in the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. Moses is out with the flocks and, you know, doing his thing, moving around and all of that. Now, the interesting thing is, where is the location of this, the burning bush? It's at Sinai, Mount Horeb. Which is interesting because God specifically says to him, you will come back to this very place. And so he's at the place where this is going to happen. And so God tells him to do what? What's in a nutshell here, chapters 3 and 4, what's happening? Moses, I've heard the cry of my people. I want you to go back and set them free. And, of course, now we have the circumstance where Moses starts doing what? I'm not sure I can do this. You know, I don't speak well. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, again, you know, when you're reading through, like, Acts 7, and Stephen is giving his account of these circumstances, and he makes the point that Moses was an eloquent man. He was very learned in the ways of the Egyptians and so forth. So he had a great knowledge. But the thing that I would point out here is, how old is he? He's 80 now, okay? And I'm sure from his perspective, he's slowed down a good bit, okay? So, from you know, now he's going to live another 40 years, but still, you know, from the time you're 40 to the time you're 80, there's a lot of changes that take place. So maybe that's part of it. Maybe he just doesn't want to do it. Maybe this is simply just a big excuse on his part. However you take it, does God buy it? Obviously not. In fact, God tells him, look, I made your mouth. Don't you think I can give you what to say? What's the problem here? And Moses just kind of keeps on, but he finally gives in. Well, what, you know, what if I go and they don't believe me and so forth? Hey, take your staff and throw it down. Well, take your hand and put it. God gives him these signs to let him know that he was in control. God was in control. And then on top of that, who does he give Moses to help him? Aaron, his own brother. And I don't know how well Moses would have known Aaron, you know, up to this point, but at any rate, they're going to be working together for this particular situation here. So, interestingly enough, Aaron becomes like the prophet of Moses, the mouthpiece for Moses. So probably a lot of the discussion that takes place between Pharaoh and Moses may actually take place between Pharaoh and Aaron in some cases. But anyway, they're both working together in this. So Moses is finally going to go. And Moses and Aaron go to Egypt, and we come to chapter 5. And I think this is a pretty important passage here that kind of sets the tone for everything happening. Moses and Aaron come to Pharaoh in chapter 5, verse 1. Thus says the Lord, this is Yahweh now. And I think it's important to bear in mind the name of God here, Yahweh. Because they're not just saying this is any old God. This is Yahweh. This is the God of the Hebrews. the God of Israel, let my people go that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go. Now, a couple things to bear in mind. Moses by now knows, you know, he knows what to say. And bear in mind, too, and we didn't mention it, we should have, but also back earlier, when Moses is concerned, when I go to the Hebrews, what should I say to them? And God says, you tell them, I am who I am, has sent me to you. So the Israelites are going to learn more about who this God is, and the Egyptians are going to learn a lot more about who this God is, and they're both going to be surprised by the effects of everything that happens here. Now, the other thing, of course, is in the next few chapters, you have this concept of the hardening of the heart. Now, God said, on the one hand, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, but other passages say he hardened his own heart. So how does that work? Did God harden his heart or did Pharaoh harden his own heart? Well, both, yeah. So how does that work? Well, could possibly be, and that did happen with Pharaoh, by the way. There were strong delusions given by his own magicians. Well, and the thing about it, you know the old adage that the same sun that softens butter, hardens clay. It's kind of that idea. You can take the very same message, and depending on the heart of the person listening, they'll either buck up against it even harder, or they'll be softened to it. And this is, you know, God doesn't turn Pharaoh into somebody that he's not. God doesn't, against Pharaoh's will, make him, you know, not want to serve God. The point is that he's taking a man who's already demonstrated that he's got the kind of heart that he has. He's not going to listen to Moses. And the more Moses says anything to him, the more he's just going to shut himself off to it. God knows this. And so the very message is going to turn Pharaoh off to the whole situation here. So really, it's both. All right, so he knows that's going to happen. Now then, you know, in the meantime, then God promises the covenant once again. And I want to go over to chapter 6 for just a moment. And I want to note the covenant aspect of what God is doing here. Say to the sons of Israel in verse 6 of chapter 6, I am Yahweh, and I'll bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I'll deliver you from their bondage. I'll also redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. Then I will take you for my people, and I will be your God. And you shall know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you to the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'll give it to you for a possession. I am Yahweh. So this is the covenant that's reestablished or, you know, reiterated once again now to Moses and the people. All right, so that's, you know, what's happening now. So when we get to chapter 7, and really the plagues take place from chapter 7 through 11, and we'll make just a couple observations here about these plagues. I do think it's kind of interesting that the plagues tend to increase in intensity. As you go. Of course, it culminates in the end with the death of the firstborn. They move, in some cases, from what you might think of as really, really serious inconveniences, you know, frogs, gnats, flies, to some very serious damage. The disease of the cattle, the massive impact on the economy that this type of thing would have. And bear in mind, too, this stretches out over a period of time. It's not like all this happens in 10 days. Okay, this happens over months of a period of time here. Two of the plagues are duplicated in some fashion by Pharaoh's own magicians, water of blood and then frogs. And interestingly enough, New Testament identifies the names as Jonas and Jambres in 2 Timothy 3:8. But basically through trickery, through the dark arts, perhaps demonic power. We don't know how they did this. They were finding some way, some fashion to imitate these particular things. But I think it's interesting because what God is doing as he intensifies this is that after just a short time, what becomes very clear? They can't do what Moses is doing by the power of God. And the longer this draws out, it's almost as if in some way God says, all right, let's start off with something everybody can do. And after a while, it's like, well, we can't do that. And in fact, as the plagues intensify, the ones with the boils, for example, what happens to the magicians? They're covered with them too. And what you're going to find is after a time, even they go to Pharaoh and say, you ought to listen to this guy. So the people are going to turn against Pharaoh. The magicians are going to turn against Pharaoh. They're all going to basically tell Pharaoh, you better listen to what this Moses guy is telling you. And of course, that just makes Pharaoh even that much more buckled up. He's not going to do it. I would also point out that the number of plagues is significant. 10 is one of those numbers. The Hebrews did put some stock in numbers. So this idea of 10 really symbolizes what? Kind of a strength. It symbolizes completion. And really the idea here that the 10 plagues were a complete judgment upon Egypt. And it demonstrates God's great power. So the purpose, for example, in Exodus 9 and verse 14, this time I will send all my plagues on you and your servants and your people so that you may know there is no one like me in all the earth. And so the plagues are establishing this fact with them. It's interesting because in 1 Samuel 4, some 400 years later, the Philistines remember how bad the plagues had been. And they talk about that, mention that. So the confrontation between Moses and Pharaoh is actually a struggle between the true God, Yahweh, and the false gods of Egypt. So in Exodus 12 and verse 12, once again, purpose statement is made. I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. Now, on the handout of the plagues, we do list several of the deities of Egypt that are defeated. And the Egyptians had lots of gods, right? I mean, when you get into polytheistic kind of a system, you end up having a different god for everything. And sometimes those gods overlap, purposes and all of that. So rather than to try to just say, well, the Nile defeated this one god, and the frogs defeated this one god, and the gnats defeated this one god, you can identify various gods that fit that. But it's probably best to see this as a total, complete judgment against all the gods, including ones that aren't even listed here. It's just kind of a total defeat of these gods here. And I think that's it's kind of an interesting thing to think about once again because of how powerful this is. And, like most pagan cultures, the Egyptians would attribute certain powers of nature to their various idols, their idol worship. And so certain gods are represented by animals, vegetation, other facets of nature. And in some cases, again, the reason for the plague would be to attack a certain god, but often to attack many gods. So, again, think of it as the whole thing. Hapi and Osiris were gods connected to the Nile River. Hecate was the goddess of childbirth. She was represented by a frog. Hathor was the mother and the goddess of the Egyptians, symbolized by a cow. You know, really flattering there, I guess. And Apis the bull. And God placed a disease on the cattle. I mean, you see the point here. I mean, these are, they do have gods that fit the mold of what these are doing here. Now, just a kind of quick rundown here, and we don't have time to go into detail with this, but a quick rundown of the plagues. Of course, the first is the water turned to blood. The annual flooding of the Nile, here's the thing, we mentioned this the other day, the annual flooding of the Nile was very important to the Egyptians. Because when the water would flood, and it still would be true today, the water would flood, recedes, what happens? That dirt is really fertile. And so it's very important that happen. And it would sometimes even turn the water to a bit of a reddish color. Why? So the dirt and so forth. You might have some red dirt. But what's demonstrated here is that this was no natural event, and it was pretty obvious the fish die. The silting of the water normally wouldn't have just killed all the fish like this, and the fact that it was affecting all the water in the land there was you know, showing that. Frogs again were not uncommon in Egypt, and typically when's the most visible time for something like frogs going to be? It would be right after the flooding. So, again, it kind of flows, you know, chronologically there because you have the Nile, you have the flooding. Now you have the frogs that would come after the flooding, and the flooding would drive them closer inland. So the sound of frogs typically in the year would be a good sign to them because it was telling them that, you know, it was doing what it was supposed to do. But here's the thing. God, in this case, takes what might have normally been desirable and turns it into something loathsome. Something that they normally would have thought, oh, that's a good thing, now becomes an absolute nightmare for them. See? And so that's when, you know, Pharaoh says, hey, Moses, got to get rid of this. Okay, well, I'll let the people go. No, I won't. No, I won't. And that's the way he does all this. So, the lice, maybe, hard to know what that is exactly, maybe some sort of mosquito kind of a thing, or biting gnats, or something along those lines would probably be the lice issue. Flies and insects, again, no mere natural occurrence. You say, well, why, can you imagine, you know, the number that would just be there if they're everywhere? You can't get rid of. There are times a year, you know, when the mosquitoes get bad enough that you just want to run from the building to your car. And you know, I remember doing a wedding up in New Hampshire years ago, and Audrey was just a toddler at that time. But as the dusk was coming on, and there was a big, you know, pond behind us, the mosquitoes got so bad that, you know, people are just scattering, you know, running for their cars, and they're grabbing Audrey and, you know, running to the car with her. I mean, they were attacking you, you know. So you can imagine when you just, you know, make this such a loathsome, nightmarish kind of a thing. And of course, the cattle, the livestock, not just the cows, but the livestock are diseased. And in ancient times, of course, wealth was measured by the inventory of livestock. So now they're losing all their wealth. It was a source of food. You get the boils, the hail, the locusts. You know, and after a while, what also becomes evident during these plagues? It's not happening to the Egyptians. I mean, it is happening. It's not happening to the Israelites. Maybe that begins to tell them something. It ought to, if nothing else, it should tell the Israelites something. They're being protected by God during all of this circumstance here. And by the way, the thing about locust plague, locust plagues were not unheard of in ancient times. Even today, you know, they're one of the most feared kind of catastrophes. If you have a locust plague, basically, every plant that's out is going to be completely consumed by them. You ever seen these pictures of, you know, kind of before and after pictures of trees? You have a nice tree, it's got all the leaves on it and all of that, and after a locust plague, it is just picked clean. Nothing. They will kill everything on it. And that's what's happening here. Now, when you have something like darkness, you actually have, it could also be kind of a psychological issue going on here. Complete darkness? You know, you ever been in complete darkness where you can't see a thing? I mean, there's just, again, it's playing tricks with your mind after a while. But even after all that, Pharaoh still isn't letting him go. So God says, here's the one that's going to do it. Be the death of the firstborn. One of the things I would get you to think about with the death of the firstborn is that it's not just little babies we're talking about here. Every family is going to have a firstborn. That firstborn might be 50 years old. Think about it. Every family is going to have... You might have a grandfather, a father, and a son all die in the same family. I mean, it's a horrific kind of a situation here. But this is the thing that's going to make Pharaoh finally say... And the thing is, he could have avoided it. Could have avoided it. Now, with that in mind, of course, this also sets up the historical context for the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the consecration of the firstborn in basically chapters 11, 12, 13. So God now tells the children of Israel, all right, you want to avoid this last plague, here's what you do. And he gives them instructions now for the Passover. And, of course, the name that we call it, Passover, is not magical, because literally, what does that come from? God actually does pass over their houses. That's where this idea comes from. So in the preparing of the Passover feast, and really the Passover feast and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread both really begin at the same time. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is actually 7 days. The Passover feast is basically on that first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So they coincide, although technically they're separate feasts, but they're often put together. And then the Feast of First Fruits occurs on the first day of the week during the middle of that. So all of this is going on at the same time. He didn't give them first fruit feast instructions until a little bit later. All right, so gives instructions for the feast and tells them down in chapter 12, verse 5, your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. Take it from the sheep or the goats. Keep it until the 14th day of the same month, and the assembly of the congregation of Israel will kill it at twilight. Take some of the blood and do what with it? Put it on the doorposts of your houses. And that way, when I see the blood, I will pass over. Now, you know, in reality, what is God doing? I mean, He's not doing this just arbitrarily. He does have an end goal in mind with this concept of the Passover, does He not? The idea... All right, think about how all this is working here. Death of the firstborn. God's going to tell the children of Israel, because I spared the firstborn, I want you to consecrate them. Carry forward to New Testament Christians. What are we? We are the church of the firstborn ones. We have been consecrated, redeemed, bought back, purchased by the blood of the Lamb. Our Passover has been sacrificed. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7, Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed. God has an end goal in mind, but it has to do with the Messiah. He's giving them events to help them bring them to that point, to understand this better. this generation isn't going to get it yet, but later it will make sense. So, point is, you know, this is not an arbitrary thing that God is doing with the people here. He's setting up this concept of redemption, helping them understand a little bit about the concept of sacrifice and what all this is going to mean, the role this is going to play in their nation. And I just want to, you know, make the point here as we think about kind of the significance of these feasts for just a moment. What is the real significance of the Passover? The one thing to kind of bear in mind is how God is very particular about their memorials. Because this is a memorial feast. It memorializes the event that was about to happen, right? And then he's going to tell them every year, this is what you're going to do. You're going to keep this feast. It's going to become a perpetual thing for you. So it memorializes the Exodus as a great act of God, the power of God demonstrated in which He makes Israel His people. Remember, He has said in chapter 6, this is the covenant I'm going to make with you. So He's already given them that idea. And this is His way of basically saying, I've purchased you with the blood to be My people. And it memorializes that. So as a memorial feast, it had very important educational implications for a Hebrew family because they would talk about it. They were supposed to talk about it. They would sit around their household table, basically, as they eat, and they would talk about it. And the meaning of the feast is given there in chapter 12 and verse 24. You shall observe this this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. When you enter the land which the Lord your God will give you, and He's promised, you shall observe this rite. And when your children say to you, what does this rite mean to you? You shall say, it is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when He smote the Egyptians but spared our homes, and the people bowed low and worshipped. So it's set up specifically so that people will ask about it. And that's the way God designed many of these memorials. You know, we might sometimes think, well, what's the point of passing around, you know, cups and the bread and all of this? And you know, well, there's a lot of points to that. But one of them is it does set up opportunities to teach people. That in doing that, we're proclaiming the Lord's death until He comes. And you're glad when somebody says, what exactly does that mean? Well, let me tell you about it. Because that's what God set memorials up for. So that people can think about it, dwell on it, and answer questions about it. And that's what they did. The Passover was a messianic feast, and we've already mentioned that. So, you know, that's something that we'll... The further we get through these books, the more we'll talk about the messianic features of this. Now, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, real quickly, the emphasis on this really was on purity. And the idea of removing leaven from your houses, it's kind of interesting that to the Jews, this idea of leavening, this process of leavening, came to be kind of symbolic of evil or whatever, and we got to remove that. Not that they never used leaven at other times of the year, but this feast was set up to help them remember the idea of purity. Remove the leaven out. Because you've got to do this quickly. Leaven takes time. You've got to do this in haste. Let me just say, though, that both of these feasts together, the import of this, the Passover was the last meal that they would eat together as slaves. And the unleavened bread was the first that they would eat together as they journey out of Egypt, again, eaten in haste because Pharaoh orders the Israelites out of Egypt immediately. And my point is this, together they commemorate the turning point for Israel. It's the end of slavery. It's the beginning of freedom, the beginning of a new life. And that dual nature of these events works well together. That every year they would participate in this They're remembering the fact that they were slaves, they've been purchased, they've been brought out of that, they're now free, and you know, are to serve and worship the Lord freely. So that's kind of the idea behind these feasts, and it's a continual memorial of that. And really in the same way, if you think about it, that's what we're doing with the Lord's Supper. We were slaves of sin. We've been purchased by the blood of the Lamb, and now we have freedom in Christ. And that feast is something that celebrates those ideas. And that's what the Passover and Unleavened Bread did. So it was meaningful. So you can imagine why later on, when the children of Israel had quit doing this, why it was such a problem. Because when they quit doing this, they quit remembering who they were. It went hand in hand. They forgot who they were. They forgot where they came from. They forgot what the point of God bringing them out of Egypt was. They just didn't remember it anymore. It didn't matter to them anymore. And that's kind of why Israel fell into such a low point later. All right, any questions, comments about any of that? I know this is a whirlwind going through this stuff. But that's what we're trying to do, is give that overview and help us kind of get that big picture of what all's going on. So by Sunday, you should have read through chapter 24, I believe. Is that correct? I think that's right. And so, once again, I just encourage you to keep reading. Just don't stop. Keep reading. And again, when you get to those points where it's like, oh, here's another genealogy, keep reading. You will find nuggets inside those genealogies sometimes. You know, there have been times I've skipped over them, and I come back later and I say, I remember that phrase being in there. And yet it tells you a great deal about something. Sometimes that's important. All right. So I appreciate it. Any final thoughts? Yeah, it's basically a way of saying, the firstborn especially belongs to God because he wasn't put to death, so God has essentially redeemed the firstborn. So that concept of consecration and redemption kind of working together there. So when we're called the Church of the Firstborn Ones in Hebrews 12, there's a lot of significance to that. It's the idea that we were not put to death, but we were rather purchased and consecrated by the blood. That's the idea. Okay? All right, I appreciate it. I'm like,